Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
From Tokyo, Japan, I'm your host, Chris Lamont, joined by my co-host, Medlir Mema. In this episode, we have the pleasure of discussing AI cooperation in the context of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, more commonly known as the Quad, with guests Hussan Jalal and Noor Long, both of the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University. Hussan Jalal is a research analyst at Georgetown, and prior to that, Jalal worked in New Delhi-based research organizations, including the Indian Ministry of Defense's Institute for Defense Studies and Analysis, and the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies, examining security issues in South Asia. Noor Long is a research analyst, also at Georgetown, focusing on China's science and technology ecosystem, AI investment trends, and AI diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific region. She is also a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global China Hub, where she focuses on China's tech, economy, and business. Prior to working at the Center for Security and Emerging Technology, Noor also worked at the Center for American Progress, where she researched China's industrial policy and 5G. Hussan and Noor, welcome to On Air.
Thank you so much for having us here.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I guess there's a round of thank yous going here. But when your report landed and I went through it, first of all, I was like, well, this is a lot of work. So I really appreciate all of you guys putting that together for the rest of us so we can kind of see there's a lot going on in terms of this relationship in the Indo-Pacific. Obviously, President Biden was in the region not too long ago. Also, you know, the countries in the region have been part of this Shangri-La kind of security dialogue. So there's a lot of discussion and, you know, of course, back and forth. Not all of it is good. And especially when it comes to the issue of AI, technology cooperation, or even competition in the region, I think there's a lot to unpack. So that's why we have you here with us today. And I really appreciate, like I said, you guys putting the report together. I think for our listeners, now, for many of us here in the region or those who have worked in the region for a long time, when you say the Quad, you know right away what that is. But, you know, that is short for something else, right? So could maybe either of you just kind of pull that apart and just tell us a little bit more what the Quad is, it's very briefly its history and what the stated goals of the organization, well, informal organization, that is.
I can take that one, Medvedev. Thank you so much for having us here. The Quad, or actually the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, it's not really an alliance. It's not a formal alliance, but it's still a very strategic grouping between four countries, which is basically the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. The Quad does not have a permanent secretariat, and it's not very institutionalized like many of the groupings out there. There are no formal agreements. Its agenda and its commitments are not very binding in nature. And because it often gets kind of criticized for being too informal or too unstructured to be effective. But nevertheless, it's such a strategic grouping of these four countries kind of coming together. And also and they've had some other of sorts, conversations with other countries as well in a Quad Plus dialogue. So that's the other thing. And I'm happy to actually go into the history of the Quad a little bit, if that's of interest at all.
Yeah, no, I want to get to the Quad Plus actually in a second, because that's actually one of the striking things. It's clear that the region is bigger than these four. And so I want to bring in the rest of the actors, so to speak, both regional and perhaps global actors. So we'll get to that. I think many people would be excused. As you pointed out, this is a very informal organization, right? If we can even call it an organization, right? It's an association of countries. I know that Japan started this early on. This is not, you know, the first time around. I think the Chinese government initially kind of laughed it off. There was a lot of skepticism about it. But it seems that over the last 2 years, it has hardened a little bit more as an association. What has happened that, you know, kind of moved from a possibly, you know, a failed experiment to something that now seems a little bit more successful and promising?
Yes, you're absolutely right about Japan being the country that sort of initiated this effort, mainly because of the 2004 earthquake and tsunami that happened in that region. There were some efforts to bring all these countries together to form efforts and release for these countries. And afterward, this grouping sort of like evolved into something with more, as you can, you've already said, has been more heartening towards, you know, the elephant in the room, which is China. And it's really interesting in a way that China was responding to how the countries are not at the leader level, but different levels of departments, you know, coming from these countries are meeting and talking about something that not entirely related to technology at the time. But currently, especially in 2019, when the group sort of like revitalized and came together to have even more concrete initiatives. And you can already see that even more concretely in the most recent Quad Summit in Tokyo, where there are a lot of initiatives coming out that are targeting different areas, including COVID-19, including climate change, technologies, and all of these areas are really important, seriously important for these countries to address, especially in the region, as well as how they're going to be facing other countries globally as well.
I was just going to add to what Noor said, just focusing on this idea that you can say the recent meetings, which have been very effective in bringing the four countries together, and the series of it was followed roughly, I would say, between this 2008 to 2017 period, where you can almost see like a hardening attitude towards China and by all the four countries for various reasons. And that's when like around 2019 is when the group really started building momentum. And actually one important factor was also raising the group meetings to ministerial levels and then the leader level summits of late. And because of that, I guess like that really like put the group a lot more into attention and like where a lot more messaging going out.
Right. So there's like a fascinating record of cooperation here. And one of the things, though, that you highlighted in this report that dealt with the Quad and AI was AI cooperation, emerging tech cooperation, something that was also emphasized at the recent Quad Tokyo Summit among the four member states. And you also kind of pointed out, and this is something that's interesting in the context of the hardening of relations with China among these four states during kind of the early years of the Quad is that, interestingly, if you map science and technology cooperation among Quad members, it looks like there's cooperation between, for example, India and the US or Japan and the US and Australia and China and Australia and the US, but they don't really cooperate with each other. What can a kind of flexible association of states that doesn't really have kind of a hard organization do to concretely reorient these nodes of scientific cooperation among research centers and researchers?
I could also take that question if need. Poussin can probably talk about the AI research side. For this report, there are two different metrics that we looked at to assess AI collaboration across all countries, as well as their ties to China. Obviously, in China, because it is, again, an important country in the region that also the US is currently competing with. And so for this report, we found that the patterns emerging from this AI collaboration among all the members suggest that, you know, they're not really collaborating with one another as much as, by that I mean India, Australia, and Japan, not collaborating with one another as much as they do with the United States. So the United States is in the center of this grouping. And, you know, like it's really interesting to see that with the flexible grouping structure, there are still a lot more attraction towards, especially towards U.S. researchers and U.S. AI companies, meaning that AI researchers from the U.S. collaborate a lot with researchers from Japan, India, and Australia. AI companies at the same time also have attracted a lot of investment from investors from these countries. So that's one really interesting finding that we noted in the report. And with this finding, we also, have offered some pathways for further future collaboration as well. Because as you can see, there are gaps in the way that they collaborate with each other already. So that's going to offer opportunities for future collaboration. So We can also dive into the specific findings that we noted in the report as well, if needed.
Yeah, I think that would be great to highlight some of these examples. So what opportunities are there for greater engagement, for example, between Japan, where Medlier and I are, and another quad country like India when it comes to AI?
I can start with the research section, actually, and I'll pass it on to Noor because she's the investment expert here. So just like Noor said, like we looked at AI collaboration between the four quad countries, specifically looking at two indicators. So across the research collaboration aspect, what we saw was that that in terms of like the share of research papers that, for example, India collaborated with the US, we saw it was 22%. And then for Australia, we saw the share was 19%. For Japan, it was also 19%. But in contrast, when you start looking at research collaboration rates between AI researchers in Australia, India, and Japan, it was roughly 4% or lesser. And this is a persistent, you can say, trend that we saw across the various metrics that we looked at within the research indicator as well. And there are actually a number of explanations as to why this is the trend and why each of them have specifically like closer AI research ties with the US, but not with each other. For one, I would say the global reputation of US universities and research institutions is a factor. And they tend to be relatively well-funded and have they tend to have more advanced equipment to conduct sophisticated research. So the US intends to be like that magnet for research. But apart from this, I would also say that there are several historical and geographical and strategic factors also at play. So for instance, US and Japan have a long-standing alliance and historically they've been cooperating and working on science and technology since the mid-60s. Australia and the US have had extensive research ties reinforced by shared language, cultural affinity, and economic ties. And India and the US also actually launched a lot of very interesting bilateral initiatives, including, for example, you have the Indo-US Science and Technology Forum, IUSSTF, which was launched in 2000 to promote long-term scientific collaborations. Plus, there's also like connection of the diaspora communities in these countries that are settled in the US that also tend to have reported collaborations with researchers back home. So all of this kind of created a scenario for like US being the hub in this hub spoke model of sorts of collaboration. And this is something similar that we saw across investments. Am I right in seeing that? Not?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the investment side, we see similar patterns. And when we look closely, you know, zoom in and look closely at the AI investment activity among all the Indo-Pacific countries, we see that Japan-India investments actually outweigh the investments between India and Australia or between Japan and Australia. But the Japanese-Indian investment flow sort of mainly one-sided, right? Meaning there's more investment coming from Japan to India and more than there is investment going to Japan from India. And what this tells us is that Japanese investors are actually really enthusiastic and excited about Indian AI companies. And one potential, you know, explanation for this is that there is an agreement between the Indian and Japanese government, that is the Indian-Japan Digital Partnership Agreement, which is to get more Japanese venture capital investors to finance Indian startups. So that's the reason why you probably see a lot of Japanese investment going to Indian AI companies. And this one example is particularly interesting because there could be more targeted reforms coming from, you know, the government from all of these four countries to actually attract more capital to fund their individuals' AI investment ecosystem. And this is also, you know, this report came out before the Quad Summit, obviously. But at the Quad Summit, we saw that the Quad Investors Network was one of the initiatives that came out of it. I'm very happy to hear that because it's really good news that these countries are thinking about using capital to fund each other's AI investment ecosystem. So that's a really good first step for these countries to move forward with.
Well, Well, here's a question that just keeps kind of reoccurring and replaying in my head. And on the one hand, I mean, the current status quo certainly favors the United States. And the part that I question is whether how genuine the United States is in kind of redistributing the existing distribution, so to speak, of both investment and research percentages. And so, you know, if I were the United States, I would not want to kind of say, you know what, yeah, all four of us should be equally interdependent and equally, you know, yoked when it comes to this issue of AI. I would actually like this hub and spoke, which you speak about in your research, this kind of arrangement where I'm at the center of all these kind of relationships, and everybody in a way is dependent on, and I also benefit both from the research and the investment here. So that's the first point. So I don't see any geostrategic kind of interest on the part of the United States to redistribute more evenly these kinds of pattern, right? Because there seems to be, there's probably a win-lose kind of scenario here. That's number one. So the second one that I'm thinking about is also just in terms of path dependence. It's really hard once certain patterns, right, set to renegotiate those and to restructure those. So once you have this hub and spoke kind of relationship, it's going to be difficult to, you know, move those away because there's obviously costs to capital movement and also individual relationships, personal relationship or university relationships. Try to move those around. So, despite what maybe we think may be the best thing to happen here, right? That is, okay, we should redistribute the burden. How likely is that to happen? And how likely is the United States is going to be a cooperative ally in this endeavor?
Well, Medler, I think you'll be surprised that how much...
I like being surprised. So that's good. So I want the optimistic scenario here. So tell me.
Yeah, I would say that it's actually quite interesting how many times the U.S. itself has emphasized on so many of its strategies, be it its Indo-Pacific strategy, or like I can speak specifically about the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence final report, which also kind of emphasizes boosting collaboration between its allies. So the U.S. government does see enhancing ties between its allies as in its own interest, and has indicated in several of its policy documents that this should be a focus.
And is there any real movement to follow up on those recommendations? Do you see anything on the investment end or on the research end, Hussan, that the U.S. is actually putting money behind these kinds of goals and objectives?
I think these often, at least in terms of the research endeavors, I think a lot of the things you write in pointing out end up being very organic, like based off of the researchers themselves. So it's very hard to kind of point out to very specific initiatives that may have been taken top down because they're so bottom up. But you still see, like, in its, at least in its policy overtures, it is very evident. And also, I think this could be perhaps a little more obvious in terms of the investment section. For direct examples, I wonder, Nora, if something comes to your mind.
Yeah, before I get there, I actually, you know, your question is super interesting because I think of it more of like a chess game more than, you know, like poker, like where you're distributing chips to players. It's more like wherever you place your capital or researchers' collaboration or ties with each other, it's a strategic move, right? These four countries have demonstrated their commitments to develop AI in a way that it's responding and aligning standards and values towards democracy. So with that goal in mind, what they are trying to do here is, you know, a collective effort to coordinate initiatives that could potentially further this goal, you know, in alignment or in a sense countering, you know, China's model that it's trying to offer to the world, a bit more authoritarian oriented. So in this like way of thinking, the US, China are the US, India, Australia, and Japan are working together to do so, because, you know, initiatives by themselves, for example, unilateral efforts to do anything like export controls or investment screening would only hurt their own industries, or hurt their own, you know, current development in-house or domestically. So without any coordination with our allies and partners, it's going to be really difficult to achieve this goal. So, you know, without thinking about how is the U.S. going to lose its share of capital or lose its share of researchers, it's less than just losing. And the distribution is also not like an entirely, you know, mutually exclusive. Like if one researcher goes to the U.S., it doesn't go to Japan. It's not that, you know, strictly speaking, it's not that way. The U.S., Japan, and India and Australia could potentially leverage their, you know, competitive advantage.
But Noor, if I may, and I know that Chris is dying to get in, so I'm just going to do this, and then I'll just be quiet for a little bit, Chris. If I just really quick, is it, and then you can, you know, kind of push back at what I'm saying here. You know, you touch on this later, and we'll talk about the Quad-China relationship. But one of the kind of talking points there is the issue of the dual nature of technology, right? United States has varying degrees of relationships with these countries, right? Australia, Japan, and India, especially given the current conflict in Ukraine. You know, India hasn't necessarily come forward as a very reliable, so to speak, partner, right? Especially dealing with some of the geopolitical struggles and challenges the United States has. And so these issues are very sensitive. So yes, of course, that, you know, a researcher may be available or investment money may be available to move around. But on the other hand, there are certain lines of research that are very sensitive in terms of security or technology or military use, dual use. And that would obviously dictate a more careful kind of calibration, not as generous of a kind of like, okay, let's just distribute this for the sake of, you know, more evening out the relationship. So that's why. So certain research relationships are going to be exclusive and not necessarily shared among all four partners here.
The research sense, I'll just say one thing and then I'll pass it on to Noor. So I think like researchers, AI research in general, like there is this call for open science and like the fact that there are ample studies that indicate that research that is developed in collaboration with more diverse teams tend to be much better and much more ethical, and like there's a lot of facts supporting this. So in that sense, I guess at least on the research front, I can say that it's very much in the interest of the United States or any other country to kind of have AI develop in such a collaborative atmosphere. And specifically when it is collaboration amongst countries with similar values, democratic values, and with an emphasis to develop responsible AI.
It's important to push back on that, actually. I think it's also, on the U.S. side, at least from the perspective of U.S. foreign policy, where it is right now, you know, the White House Indo-Pacific strategy, it's pretty clear that the U.S. will not only need to, you know, repair U.S. alliance and opening up to the world again, but also to, it's pretty explicit that it's going to need U.S. allies and partners to step up. And it's rallying, encouraging more of those countries to work with one another. And so, you know, it's with that emphasis, it's going to be the world where the U.S. really wants to reconnect and also encouraging other countries to reconnect and not just you know, pursuing unilateral efforts where it's going to be wasted if it were to be done alone. So I just wanted to emphasize on that point when you asked about whether they are thinking about, you know, balancing the idea of how much they're going to lose industry share or others. Again, the point about them not coordinating, that cost is going to outweigh other benefits, you know, tiny benefits that could potentially come currently in its status quo. So I think that point needs to be made to answer your question. So I'll stop here.
Right. Absolutely, Noor. And one thing that I kind of wanted to ask you in relation to this was where you had mentioned or you emphasized, and both of you have been emphasizing that, well, Quad countries have to get something out of this relationship, right? That if it's kind of a unilateral demand being placed, whether it's export controls or technology transfer from the U.S. That has economic costs on them, there has to be something more. And if you put this in the context of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is something that on the one hand, was seen as, was framed as being ambitious. But when it comes down to it, a lot of countries in the region were kind of pointing out that, well, you know, it doesn't really give us anything, right? It doesn't give us kind of access to US markets. So if the US is going to promote this relationship, it seems like there aren't a lot of alternatives, right? Because the US can't be everywhere. And perhaps in the end, it's better that a Indian startup develops innovative programs or systems using Japanese investment than when US is not really on the table there, vis-a-vis another third country that doesn't share these values, perhaps. So are these all, I'd assume these are all interrelated, right, with the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework and other initiatives that the US is pushing in the region.
Right. And analysts or observers would definitely see the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework as sort of like an alternative to China's, you know, asserting itself in other institutions like the RCEP and also CPTPP. It's offered like an alternative, but again, you noted that there are definitely some limitations to what the US can offer. So in a way, you can probably read this as the US kind of, there are the important players in the region, especially Japan, that are also offering that increasing their role in the region and offering in a way support to other countries. Like Japan, for example, has been reasserting itself a bit more in the Indo-Pacific region, especially as you've seen recently with you know, Chinese military exercise in the region. That scares Japan a little bit, in a sense. So you can say at the very least that Japan is wary of China. And the US has been trying to rekindle or, I guess, increase its ties with this country, especially as you can see in, you know, Joe Biden's visit to Japan and the release of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So I guess, in short, to answer your question, if you were to ask about what role can the U.S. play in the region and what other players are stepping up, like I think it's both the fact that the U.S. is stepping up and offering opportunities to other countries to also step up. So ultimately, that's the way to work together to achieve common goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Just especially in the context of the war in Ukraine and growing kind of U.S. recommitments, redevotion of resources to Europe, if Japan or other regional powers can share a little bit more of the burden of regional security, then of course this is something that would be in Washington's interest. But one thing that we kind of skirted around here was the integration of other states and other actors into this flexible framework, right? Because it's flexible, it's kind of without kind of a strong institutional organizational basis. You can kind of make of it what you want. What about bringing other countries in? We talked about Quad Plus a little bit earlier. I think, Hassan, you had mentioned that. Can you tell us a little bit more about potential enlargement of this network of countries?
Yeah, sure, Chris. So the Quad Plus format actually came into the picture, you can say, about around 2020 when the Quad countries wanted to coordinate their efforts in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think this is mainly done in coordination with New Zealand, South Korea, and Vietnam. And then I believe later on, Brazil and Israel were also invited, interestingly, to discuss kind of distribution of vaccines. So in that sense, like, that's been so far the overtures, but there have been so many cases that have been made about expanding this. And for that matter, the Quad framework itself talks a lot about inclusivity and kind of reaching out to other organizations and countries within the Quad framework. I mean, for example, I would say like ASEAN often kind of figures in a lot of the conversations. And I believe in February of 2022, when the Quad foreign ministers met, they even agreed that one of the suggestions from the Australian counterparts was that the Quad should be expanded to include other dialogue partners. And yeah, of course, like regional organizations like ASEAN and the Indian Ocean Rim Association, like one can imagine them definitely to be part of the Quad meetings. But it's kind of also interesting to, it's important to remember that most of the other groups, unlike the Quad, are not institutionalized. So like the other perhaps idea for this could be the Quad itself becoming a dialogue partner with these regional institutions in that sense, kind of like, so like that is one way. And perhaps, of course, the other option is what happened for the COVID-19 vaccine that could be perhaps expanded to all the other topics that the Quad is working on. This includes the emerging technology space and cybersecurity and even climate change for that matter. And perhaps like having more informal consultations or maybe partnerships in working groups of these countries would be really good to see.
But doesn't the expansion, right? I mean, I agree with you, and it's surprising to me, right? And one of the questions I had was, why stop at four? Why do the Quad? You can do something broader than that. There's obvious partners in the region here. South Korea, for example, is missing. Wondering why they're not in there. So maybe start with that, and then I have a related question to that. Noor, any reasons why, for example, South Korea is not part of this? You would seem an obvious candidate for being part of this cooperation.
Yes. So on the South Korea question, the country has asked to be an observer of the Quad Summit. So it has already just demonstrated, you know, commitment and interest in joining if that is an opportunity that arises. But your question about why, like, you know, not South Korea at the moment, I think it goes back to the first formation of the Quad, like how and why was it formed initially in 2004, and how it evolved over time. I think as we're tracking this evolution, we're probably going to see more countries joining. And if the group itself has thought about, expanding to include countries that are relevant, depending on the situation they are in, depending on the issues that it's trying to solve. Currently, it's the main focus is on, you know, COVID-19, the pandemic itself, climate change and technology. And so you can probably view this as an experiment. At one point, there will be diminishing marginal return to, you know, expanding the group. So given that it's a recent development that this group has now come together to launch really concrete initiatives, I think it's safe to say that they're currently working on something that they could potentially expand in the future to include countries like South Korea.
Yeah, so one of the diminishing returns that I'm thinking of, and, San, you mentioned this issue of expansion beyond the original four to include also ASEAN kind of as an organization in forum, but also as well as, you know, the member states of those organizations. You know, the attraction of the Quad, at least the way you lay out in the report, is also that you have these strong established democracies, right? And so, especially when it gets to the issue of emerging tech, you know, and again, you point out in your report that you know that this is not going to be misused in authoritarian kind of regimes. Well, the moment you expand this beyond these, again, strong traditional democracies, that undermines the argument that, you know, it's okay to strengthen the cooperation within the Quad Plus, because this is only going to serve to, the technology is only going to go to established democracies that will not misuse this. And by the way, that's also the argument for moving away from cooperation with China, which we've been dancing around that, and we're going to get to that right after this question. But so on one hand, I ask the question, why not expand? But on the other hand, does the expansion of Quad actually undermine the argument for why you should move investments away from other countries and refocus those among the four countries?
I think I'll just say one point and I'll pass it on to Noor for the investments side. It's important to kind of like, I think like Quad gets criticized for its informal structure, but I think it's really important to remember that this informal structure really brings in that flexibility of adding more partners or having more observers, bringing them into the picture. So the original, I would say the four countries for that matter, make for like a good group of sorts that brings together and kind of rallies some of the important topics that need attention. And, you know, the Indo-Pacific region is really complicated with each country having their own limitations with regard to China, what they can speak, what they cannot. I mean, so South Korea, it's a different range of issues here. So in that sense, I guess like it's because I would just credit the informal structure of the grouping itself to kind of ensure those kind of pathways in for others.
I would also add that expansion to, you know, non-major democracies is a question for very far future. And, you know, in relations to what's the U.S. has been done, been doing with ASEAN, the Quad could be seen as a stabilizing body in the region, meaning that there is a group that could coordinate and respond to issues immediately. Any issues that could potentially come up in the region, this group could be seen as a, again, like a regional stability, like a body that could ensure regional stability in the region. And so that could be something that ASEAN is viewing at the Quad. But at the same time, like I recognize that there are many other challenges, you know, as China has accused the Quad as being, you know, Asian NATO. That's also an issue that comes up, and ASEAN is thinking and really paying a close attention to the development, any development that the Quad has made. And so it's important to watch that part of the country, part of the world as well. And Singapore is definitely one of the countries that is interested in what the Quad is doing.
This gets us to a question that Medlier has been hinting at asking throughout the episode, and that's the question of whether or not the Quad is more of an anti-China grouping as opposed to a grouping that is promoting cooperation organically or regional stability or these other regional goods, such as the provision of vaccines and other sectors of cooperation. And as we saw at the Shangri-La dialogue in June of this year, the Chinese quite aggressively attacked the Quad in statements by China's defense minister, Wei Feng, who accused the United States of being things like a bully and hijacking countries around the region, particularly kind of singling out many members of the Quad in that. How realistic is deepening cooperation with ASEAN among countries that are seeking to be seen, at least, and perceived as not falling into this new Cold War framework, perhaps between Beijing and Washington? How easy is it going to be for them to engage with the Quad going forward in the face of this increasing hostility coming from Beijing as they negotiate their own relationships?
You are absolutely right about the fact that, you know, China views the Quad as has a very negative, you know, attitude towards the Quad. I'll discuss that a little bit, and I'll turn to Hassan to talk about how the Quad sees China. And to start, yes, absolutely. China has been, you know, long dismissive of the Quad since the beginning of the grouping itself. And in addition to that foreign minister at Shangri-La Dialogue, Wang Yi, who's another the Chinese foreign minister, he's, you know, has been saying a lot of things about the Quad, for example, like how it is like a seafoam. It's going to dissipate really quickly after, or that it is disrupting peace in the Indo-Pacific region. So all of these, you know, rhetoric towards Quad showing that China is not happy with what the Quad is doing. And, you know, in the background of that as well, China is also aware that the U.S. is currently changing its policy from engagement to strategic competition, right? So with that in mind, that there's a lot of reasons for China to be dismissive and to be negative towards the Quad. And yes, the Quad recently has been more concerned of China's disruptive behavior in the region, right? And that includes, you know, what's happening in the South China Sea, human rights issue in Xinjiang, China's relations to Russia in light of the war in Ukraine. And so with all of these issues, you know, putting all these issues together, there's a lot of reasons for the Quad to be thinking about how to respond to China's unexpected behavior in the region in the future, right? But currently, again, the grouping is very, there's no hard commitment that one country has to say, yes, I'm on board if you are doing this. There's a lot of negotiation, there's a lot of conversations moving forward. And we've seen that, you know, with this flexible grouping, like Sun has mentioned, there's benefits to that too. So they're going to take it case by case from where we're standing.
I think I'd like to unpack one of Medlier's question. I know he mentioned about this idea about like, why is Quad, why is it not engaging with China? Like this question between confrontation versus engagement with China in that sense. And I mean, if you ask me, I think that neither confrontation nor engagement really presents a very viable approach when it comes to the Quad in China, firstly. At the same time, I'll tell you why. So I would say that some of the very foundations of the Quad's early engagements, like since they were based a lot on the desire to counter China's disruptive behavior in the region, in that sense, Quad, I guess, engaging with China is pretty much out of the question. And this is something that will not officially get acknowledged in most of the Quad summits, but that part is a little on the side. Plus, in addition to this, each of the four Quad countries have also witnessed an increase in intentions in their bilateral relations with China, especially in recent years. So beyond like a bilateral format in which they already kind of have conversations with China, or like they're engaging in several other multilateral groupings with China, I don't see the Quad Forum being used for any dialogues and engagement with China. Like, that's one thing. On the confrontation side, I would say that I'd like to emphasize that, like, even though increasing Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific region was actually what kind of gave renewed meaning to the Quad, China is admittedly like one of the particular negative subjects amongst the four Quad countries, which they don't want to engage much on. So assuming that the Quad ever even decides to engage in a confrontation with China, for now it really seems that there will be kind of a lack of consensus between the four on how to even deter Beijing, for example. I mean, I can say that Australia and Japan, for instance, they have so many economic pacts with and free trade deals with China, and it kind of reflects their desire to do business with China, even as they're willing to kind of work towards like deterring its growing clout in the region. India, on the other hand, might be willing to help with capacity building if it comes to it, but when it actually comes to taking any risks that might involve violence or escalation, let's say, for example, in the South China Sea, assuming, it might not be really ready to do something like that, especially since it may upset the situation for its territorial borders with China. And then, of course, the US, on the other hand, is willing to intervene in any way that safeguards its interests and also kind of is ready to make any investments that when it comes to competing with China. So in that sense, like, I think the Quad very much realizes this, and that's why they kind of keep the question about China out of its talks. For now, I would say, like, at best, the Quad is preparing for a situation where it might have to confront China, and it might probably be at the very, very early start of that, like, but it's nowhere close to kind of taking any confrontational stance, for instance. And there's still like a lot of work that the four countries need to do together if they ever want to reach that stage. And they probably in this process might never even spell it out. That's also something. These are official.
Here's the thing, though, and this, again, reflects a little bit some of the language that is found in your report as well. The phrase that you use is about, you know, decreasing dependence, reducing dependence on the Chinese market. You're saying that there are actually, this quote, there are nonetheless powerful diplomatic, security, and economic incentives to strengthen technological collaboration between the United States and its three Quad allies, while reducing dependence on the Chinese market. And, you know, if I may, Hussein and Noor, I remember Noor earlier was saying, well, it doesn't have to be either or, this is not like redistributing the chips, it's more of a chess game. But when it comes to China, it becomes all about redistributing the chips, right? In the sense that it becomes a zero sum. It becomes like, if we rely on China for some of these markets, if we collaborate with China on technology, both in terms of investment and research, well, then we lose and China wins. However, you know, in the case of the United States, if we shuffle away some, you know, or we redistribute, you know, this make it a bit more even, the relation between the United States and its Quad allies, that's okay. The United States won't care about this because, you know, we will have actually a strong relation between its allies, and the United States wants this. And there are two different logics at play here. And that's where I come back to this. If this is, in fact, a battle of, you know, titans between the United States and China, it's clear that we're being set up for a zero-sum kind of competition, right? It's going to be a win-lose one. There are a lot of people that would actually be very uncomfortable with that kind of language about reducing dependence on Chinese markets, Chinese research, and even reducing kind of relationships with Chinese researchers. Because there's at least one school of international relations that talks about the importance of institutional interdependence. And that institutional interdependence actually can lead to more peaceful relationships. And we just had, actually, in our program, Dan Churiak talks about, you know, trade peace or capitalist peace, or talks about, you know, we can talk about democratic peace theory, right? Whatever it is, there are different ways of kind of labeling this. But, I mean, the whole point of having China be in the international kind of institutional framework, joining the WTO and others, was the premise that once China joins institutions, that would, in a way, mitigate away China's authoritarian and perhaps more problematic aspects. Now, that hasn't quite played out, and maybe that's reflected in your report, in the sense that, well, it's not like China has changed its behavior, so why hope that it will continue to do that anyways? But I guess for me, that's the thing. It's not about confrontation or about even just cozying up even more to China. But why reduce dependence, or why reduce relationship? Because reducing dependence is also reducing relationships, right? That's the same thing with China. Why not say, okay, we should engage more with one another, but that doesn't necessarily have to come at the cost of relationships with China. And I sound here like I'm really, like, you know, speaking on Chris and I will have a conversation about this later. You know, I'm very critical of China generally, just that there is just this implicit kind of language in the report, but just generally in the conversation, not just here, but overall, that, you know, we should just now put China in the corner and then just play among each other.
I'll say this very quickly, because as you know, already laid out here, engagement with China did not work as much as we, you know, to meet the goals that we wanted to meet earlier. And U.S. policymakers have recognized that. That's why we're shifting that away, a little bit away from that mentality and moving towards competition with China. And you are right about the two points being very different from another, the two logics going on here. When the China factor is in the equation, what the Quad countries are thinking is quite different from what they're thinking internally when they, you know, hoping to strengthen relationship with one another, because of the idea that one of their goals is to develop AI or other emerging technologies that align with democratic values. And so recognizing that China has, you know, misused technologies for other, you know, malicious uses, for example, what's happening in Xinjiang, and as well as, you know, efforts to also explore digital authoritarianism models as well. And so with this in mind, what we are seeing in and also have highlighted in the report is that when, you know, either in the research community and also the investment community, when there's a lot of dependency on Chinese capital market and also talent, in a sense that they are using that to develop very sensitive critical technology for that has national security implications. With that caveat, right? Because there are definitely, like Hussein has mentioned before, open science and globalized investment community, that's what, you know, pushing and fostering innovation. But there are certain areas where technology is super sensitive. It's it's extremely critical for national security and other military, you know, development as well. And so in that areas, that's when the Quad countries are thinking about, hopefully they're thinking about developing certain efforts to counter that you know, proliferation of Chinese capital and other market dependency. So with that, I'll turn to Usami. What are further thoughts on this?
Yeah, thank you, Noor. I think you put that very, very well. I'll just add like one more point to that. I think like the way to see this, Medler, would be not, so this is not about kind of reducing dependence on China and like kind of putting it in a situation which is less advantageous versus the others. It's actually more about leveling the playing field. So if you see right now, China is pretty much embedded in across, I would say, South Asia and Southeast Asia, like in supply chains, in even for US for that matter, to a large extent, and other countries. So it's present in the market, and is at the same time, like Noor already pointed out to quite a few, but like at the same, like there's so many other malpractices, you can say, for example, be it predatory loans or like so many other things that, you know, countries do worry about. I'll just give you one small example, for example, about like conversations about Huawei and ZTE technology in India. So this is around the time of the increasing tensions on the border with China. And this is, it's been part of like the past, I would say specifically the past decade, it's been on and off, and especially recently, really increased a lot more. And the Indian government has continuously spoken about removing some of this Chinese technology that is in its telecommunications, embedded in its telecom sector, and also kind of in very much in its government apparatus. But despite this emphasis, it's still, it's like in some sense it's still work in progress, and like it's the Chinese presence in the Indian market has been is established fact of sorts, and yeah, I mean what I'm trying to say is that even if so, like with Huawei that had a smaller footprint in the US, the aspect, so getting rid of Huawei, let's just delete that part.
Go ahead. Reform. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. There's so many thoughts that were coming to mind, but I'll just pause there. Yeah.
Do you want to just end with one last, maybe a final paragraph, or?
I will just say that. I mean, ultimately, so it's really honestly more about just leveling that playing field, just because China is already so very very well embedded in, I would say, so many countries' supply chains, be it specifically in the technology sector, be it 5G, be it in semiconductors, and so on and so forth. So,
one thing that neither of you, I think, really mentioned in the response is Taiwan and contingency planning for what might or might not happen in Taiwan. And we've just seen kind of Russia crash out of the global capitalistic economy. And if you're an investor now and you're thinking about stability, how attractive is putting a lot of money into something that is vulnerable to supply chain disruptions with China at particularly this moment in time? And are you looking for alternatives? And perhaps, Sana, Noor, are we seeing that, or it might be too early to ask this question, but changes in investment patterns in this part of the world as a result of what we've seen in February 2022 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
So we do have a project that looks at U.S. outbound investment to China. And it was before we did the calculation and analysis before the what's happened in Ukraine. So we probably won't observe that in the trends that we've seen for this report. But you're absolutely right there. I think there are two main reasons investors might be thinking about recalibrating their strategy towards how they're thinking about whether, you know, to increase capital in China or not. So what's happening in Chinese market, there's a lot of issues coming from the government itself with the tech crackdown. So there's a lot of uncertainty coming, you know, there's a lot of signals going, telling investors that, okay, this maybe the sector is a bit more risky to invest in, or that if they are doing their due diligence, very well, they also probably see issues that perhaps like there's connections between companies that they're investing in with Chinese government, or their technologies are being used for, you know, other military uses. And so that's one factor. The other one is what the U.S. is thinking, or what other countries are thinking about in, capital going into China, or capital coming out of China, helping companies develop, especially in AI. And so, you know, you've heard a lot about investment restrictions or investment screening mechanisms that are specifically targeting pieces of technologies that could be potentially used for, you know, either for human rights violation or for related to the PLA. And so there's a lot of thinking about that. And I don't have a clear answer to how investors currently are thinking, but they are getting the signals, right? What's currently happening in the market itself and what are the restrictions that are being placed on Chinese companies versus Chinese capital going to other countries. And so, and it's not just the US per se. Australia has also been thinking about it. Japan has its own industry specific investment screening mechanism. And so there are these countries are already starting to think about like how they can rethink the use of Chinese capital going into their own companies. So with that, like I think we'll probably do a lot more projects than that in the future.
Hassan and Noor, can you tell us a little bit more about your future work going forward on these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a particular line of research that looks at what is happening in the Indo-Pacific region. So Hassan and I are the ones looking at AI collaboration in particular. So the Quad project is one of the initial projects that are coming out from this line of research. The other one we're looking at is Chinese investment and market strategies in Southeast Asia. So some of the stuff that I talked about here is also hinted at one of this project as well, but it's very initial. So hopefully that will come out in a couple of months or so. In addition to that, as I mentioned before, we have a project with my other colleague at CSET, Emily Weinstein, who looks at generally export controls. And so this project will focus on U.S. outward investment to Chinese AI companies. And we're looking at how to assess risk when it comes to U.S. capital going into these companies and what other strategic collaborations they're doing with these companies. And lastly, I personally looked at, it's a pet project of mine, so I'm hoping to push this out a little bit, looking at going back to what is happening in China domestically, so its own financial ecosystem, so particularly on the publicly traded investment platform, and how it's getting a lot of government support for these companies to list there. So with that, I'll turn to Hassan. I think she has a really cool project coming up too.
Thank you, Noor. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess just in case you've not already had enough of research and investment discussions of the Quad, there's another project we have on that looks at patents and patenting ties between the Quad countries. And that essentially is a metric that looks more onto, it's looking at research with more in developmental phase. So like what is really getting developed on ground. In terms of AI technologies amongst the Quad countries. So that is one thing. And other than that, there is a web interface that we're building, which we're calling the Country AI Activity Tracker or the CAT Tracker, which essentially is our way of kind of, we're hoping to make this, we work on a lot of very, very cool data. We're very fortunate to work on very interesting data sets at CSET. And we just want more researchers to be able to look at the same data and make their own assessments. And through the CAT tracker, we're hoping to make our data sets on research in patents and companies and investment more accessible to everyone. And so you can essentially look at progress in countries across like globally, looking at how much do countries, for example, like the same metrics that we looked at. So looking at various indicators within each of these three data sets. So yeah, we're very excited about that one. That should be out hopefully in September. And I guess, I hope everyone finds it interesting.
Well, thank you very much. That's actually, again, really interesting stuff. We always enjoy the products that come out of CSET. We did have Emily Weinstein here in our program a while back. And so we look forward to having you and your colleagues back on our program. As we've been hinting at, especially in the region, this smells like the opening scenes of a tech cold war between the United States and China. And this, but at the same time, there's this optimistic kind of side to all this, as you're pointing out, right? There's a lot of very interesting exchanges that are happening regionally and globally. So we look forward to exposing and to exploring all those questions. And I hope that our listeners have enjoyed this conversation as much as we have. And of course, we look forward to future iterations of the report and other reports, and having, of course, you back on our program. Meanwhile, for our listeners, I hope that this has been a stimulating conversation. If you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can find us also on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at onair_podcast. Don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.